Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome everybody to this episode of the Irish Economics Podcast. So today's episode is on the economics of infrastructure investment and the public-private mix in public service delivery. So the central question here is why should the private sector, or that's private businesses from Ireland and abroad, why should they participate in the delivery of public services? And this is investments in infrastructure like hospitals, roads and telecoms. And if there's a rationale for this, then what's the best way to go about incorporating the private sector into the provision of public services? So we'll discuss the general idea here and Ireland's experience in this regard, which has been met with various degrees of success. So I'm joined by Professor Owen Reeves, who's head of the Department of Economics at the University of Limerick, and also Donald Palchik, who is lecturer in economics at the University of Limerick. So welcome both.
Thanks.
So I suppose to start from the beginning then, we'll just think about the theory and the background behind public-private partnerships. What exactly are they and how should they be used best?
Yeah, I think the starting point here, Niall, really is if you consider the fact that today most countries, including Ireland, face huge challenges around infrastructure policy, particularly in relation to actually investing in new infrastructure and actually renewing old infrastructure. This is a major issue for economies, especially where there's a need for fiscal discipline or there are fiscal constraints that apply. And when one considers that there's in the region, I've seen one estimate that states, it comes from McKinsey, that suggests that there's 120 trillion of private finance swishing around the world looking for a home. Governments are eager to tap into that private finance in order to direct towards the provision essentially of public infrastructure, like the types of assets you describe, be it in transport infrastructure like motorways or light rail systems, water infrastructure, social infrastructure like schools and hospitals and so on. So this is one of the rationales for the devising of a model that we call the public-private partnership, right, which is really a procurement mechanism and a means of A, financing, B, funding and providing actual infrastructure. So essentially what a PPP is, it's a long-term infrastructure contract whereby the private sector put the upfront finance, okay, put that up for investment. They then design, they build and they operate the asset over the life of the contract, which is normally, you know, a 25, 30, 40-year period. And one of the big advantages for governments as a result of the private sector coming in with private finance is that it can be treated off balance sheet, depending on the fiscal rules that apply in a country. But that was a big attraction for the use of PPPs in the UK, which is probably the world leader in the use of PPP.
So what's off balance sheet, what does that mean?
What that essentially means in terms of the calculation of the fiscal aggregates, like the general government deficit, for instance, or the level of government debt, in a sense, the rules allow for the spacing out over the payment back, okay, for the infrastructure over the life of the asset, okay. Whereas under the old fiscal rules, the government would borrow. Sorry, not the old fiscal rules, but rather the old way of doing things, like traditional procurement methods. The government would borrow, and that would show up as borrowings on the government books in the first 2 years, you know, of the project life cycle. Mm-hmm. Under PPP, because the private sector does the borrowing and the government pays back then over the life of the contract, the what's shown up in terms of government expenditure is spread out over time and you don't have this big hit on government debt at the very beginning.
Okay, but the overall liability to the government doesn't change much, does it?
Absolutely. So some economists have referred to this as a fiscal illusion.
Yeah.
An economist will see it exactly for what it is. You know, yeah. The government is still paying for it here. Now, you could, of course, there's another attraction is that the funding, which is the payback over time, some of that can come from user charges. And there might be an attraction around that. Think in terms of toll roads and so on. But we can maybe perhaps get back to that. But you're right. You see it for what it is. There's no free lunch here. The government and or the service user is actually going to pay back for this over the life of the contract. So even though it's an attraction, we can see through that as economists. As
yeah, and then the other aspect is that the cost of borrowing for a private sector is greater than
yeah, well, that's a really big issue because, you know, in global terms, the use of PPP really kicked off in 1992 when the UK launched what they call the Private Finance Initiative.
Right.
Okay. So other countries joined in, as it were, and followed suit in subsequent years. So Ireland actually announced the first PPPs in 1999, 7 years later. I mean, having looked across the water, facing similar challenges, even more acute in Ireland at the time because the economy was really growing rapidly and there were clear infrastructure shortages. So the government came up with this idea, we'll experiment with PPP, they seem to be working okay in the UK, and we'll pilot a number of projects. So we've now had about 20 years experience with the use of PPP in Ireland. So roughly about 5 to 6 billion worth in terms of capital funding of investment has happened through PPP. The payback on that over time will be expected to be in the region of about 10 billion. They're the commitments, you know, under the total PPP program. The assets that have been built to date, I would say roads or motorways dominates in terms of the aggregate value of the assets that have been built. But PPPs have been very prevalent in, we'll say, social infrastructure, particularly schools and other educational facilities. Yeah. So I think in the region of 27 schools have been built under, you know, bundled projects. You've got 5 or 6 schools in one contract. They're currently under construction, the primary care centres, other assets like the National Convention Centre, the Criminal Courts Complex, and so on. So these are the assets that are there, they're up and running, and when you stand back and you say, well, look, they've actually delivered the infrastructure, we've got what we wanted.
Yeah.
That appears to be an indicator of success. But a few moments ago, you asked me a question about the cost of borrowing. You know, as economists, we need to stand back and think, okay, how do we assess PPPs in terms of whether they were successful or not? And success can mean different things to different people.
Yeah.
But for economists, I think success is measured in terms of, we'll say, efficiency or cost efficiency. And you steered me towards where we need to go, because when you consider the cost efficiency aspect, the language tends to refer to consider this in terms of value for money. But if value for money is to be achieved under PPP, two major hurdles has to be jumped. One is the higher cost of private borrowing. You have to create efficiencies that outweigh those higher costs. So typically, it depends, of course, on the country. It depends at the point in time. But the literature would suggest, on average, the private cost of borrowing will be between 1% and 3% higher for the private sector. Okay.
Right.
And when I explain this in the classroom, I tend to suggest if your mortgage, the rate of interest on your mortgage went up by 3%. You know, over a 20-25 year mortgage, that would have a major, major impact in terms of what you pay back over time.
Yeah.
So that's a big hurdle. But the second hurdle, and one that gets probably less attention, but it gets plenty of attention in the relevant literature, are what we call the transaction costs. They're the costs of organising the procurement and the management of PPPs from start to finish. They are shown to be quite significant, and they can be, I would say, ballpark about 10% of the project costs under PPP, which would be higher than under traditional procurement. So if you consider the higher cost of borrowing, the higher level of transaction costs to actually make, to ensure that PPP delivers value for money relative to traditional procurement, and we need to maybe talk about that as well, because that's problematic. But to deliver value for money vis-a-vis traditional procurement, enough efficiencies have to be generated in order to account for those extra costs.
Yeah, so to elaborate on transaction costs, that's basically the cost of the public body dealing with the private body. That's in case people aren't familiar with that. One thing that just came to mind before we move on is there's all these additional costs, but would there have been hurdles, political hurdles, that were able to be jumped over with a PPP that maybe wouldn't under traditional?
Well, that's interesting, because when if you look back at the history, obviously PPP, if you just look at, let's say, the UK and Ireland as good examples, the political hurdles weren't that big originally,
right?
Because the idea, if you think back in 1999, that was the year Aircom was privatised, for instance. So the idea of privatising public services wasn't exactly anathema to the government at the time. Irish governments are, they tend to be, they're certainly not very left of centre, and so they're open to the idea of privatisation, generally speaking, but in a cautious sense, and that's why PPP was it got a smooth passage at the very beginning, yeah. back in the late 1990s. But that has actually changed, because we've learned a lot over the 20 years that have gone by in the meantime with the experience of PPP. And I would be of the opinion that PPP now are treated far more sceptically by government. And right. It's because we know more about how they work, or rather how they don't work.
Right, okay, that's interesting. So you mentioned the traditional procurement. So what would be issues there?
If you're to assess PPP, you have to compare it to something. So, I mean, the government has choices when it has to make decisions around the provision of infrastructure. So they can use state-owned enterprises. State-owned enterprises, for instance, will be a channel for about a fifth of the total amount that will be spent under the current National Development Plan. So that's one vehicle through which governments can channel finance for the provision of infrastructure. But the others are more market-oriented approaches, and I think PPP falls into that. But PPP is really an alternative to what we call traditional procurement, whereby the government would, if you go turn the clock back 20 years and you think of a traditionally built road, the government would hold a tender for a contract to design the road, okay? And then another contract to construct it. So separate contracts, they'd be short enough in time-wise, and when the contract, when the asset is then in operation, it reverts back to the ownership and the control and the management of the state. But under PPP, the private sector, for instance, is now operating schools. It's operating the National Convention Centre. It operates the motorways, and the contracts are for 20 or 30 years. And it's a completely different... There's a lot of virtue to that, because the advantages, as we talked about, the hurdles that must be overcome in order to generate the efficiencies under PPP. Well, what theory essentially suggests is that the two advantages are that by virtue of integrating the different elements of a project life cycle, the design, the build, the operate, the finance, into one single contract, this creates incentives for the private sector to economise and to ensure that the quality of the asset that they'll eventually end up operating is sufficient. So, I mean, they have an incentive to make sure that they don't cut back on construction costs.
Yeah.
Okay. Because they'll have to deal with that under the terms of the contract, because they have to maintain and operate it over a 20 or 30 year period.
Okay.
And what that actually means really is that they're taking on risks. Okay. So risk is being shared under the PPP model with the private sector. And that's another advantage, because if that's nailed down pretty well in a contract, and a contract is well managed, and the private sector is monitored closely.
Yeah.
If they screw up, and if they don't perform, they should therefore be penalised.
Yeah.
Now, all again, sounds good in practice, but the reality worldwide, using international data, is that over 50% of PPP contracts tend to be renegotiated. Now, what that means, and these are kind of things that people in this field tend to study, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. So, I mean, on the one hand, you could say renegotiations are inevitable in terms of a long-term infrastructure contract as circumstances change.
Yeah.
But the data shows that a lot of renegotiations actually happen in the early start. In the early period of the contract, over the first 2 years, and the majority of renegotiations are to the advantage of the private sector. So this raises questions about whether the private sector contractors maybe, lowball in order to win contracts, whether they're behaving opportunistically, And
once you get the foot in the door,
exactly,
then.
which again brings you back to this, to where we started. You know, ultimately, do we think that PPP will yield value for money?
Yeah.
And I suppose, I mean, I think about these things a lot. And if I was to give a very simple answer, is A, there's not a lot of very reliable empirical evidence to show that it does or doesn't one way or the other. Yeah. But if one was to advise governments in relation to how PPPs could yield the advantages that proponents would suggest, it comes down to governance. It comes down to good management. It comes down to the public sector learning how to deal with the private sector in this new environment whereby they're flocking to infrastructure projects, yeah, if the terms and conditions are right. But that's really challenging for governments. So in this country, you know, in the mid-2000s, the government established the National Development Finance Agency, a specialist procurement agency for the delivery of PPPs. And there's evidence to suggest that there's enough expertise there to give us comfort in the sense that we can believe to a large degree that they've managed a number of these PPPs pretty well. Roads infrastructure was procured separately, but then what was the National Roads Authority, now Transport Infrastructure Ireland, they built up a lot of expertise as well. But what I'm trying to get at here is that those institutions that need to be put in place in order to ensure that the governance of PPPs is efficient, you can't take those for granted. They don't exist in every country. Okay. And it takes time for them to build up, actually. So that has happened in Ireland to a degree, but there's still an awful lot we need to know about, yeah, how these have performed. So, yeah.
So one, when you mentioned the risk sharing, so that seems attractive in the sense that we don't know how the costs are going to turn out, and it can be a big burden for the public sector to take on this, the taxpayer. So it's good to strike a certain price early on and let the private sector take on that risk. But if it's going to be renegotiated, well, then they're not sharing that risk as well as the
country. Exactly. That's one of the, you know, that's one of the pitfalls. That's one of the dangers, you know, of long-term, yeah, contracting. That's, I mean, that happens in private contracting, public-private contracting, and so on. And I mean, long-term contracting is very prevalent in the private business world. So that's a challenge for all types of contracting. But I would, you know, you have to look at individual cases to understand how this actually plays out.
Yeah.
And one of the cases that's, you know, on the agenda right now is the case of the National Broadband Plan. So this is being procured using a PPP, and it will be the biggest PPP that was ever contracted for in this country.
Yeah.
Now, we're at the very late stages. It looks like the government, against a lot of advice, is going to sign a final contract before the end of the year to roll out rural broadband infrastructure to rural Ireland.
Yeah.
But we've learned a lot about that contract over the last number of months, and one of the many issues that have been highlighted are concerns about whether this PPP contract will actually contain the kind of provisions that we'd like to see to ensure that risk has been optimally shared between the parties, and that the private sector that is going to win this contract, going to sign this contract, is actually taking on enough risk.
Yeah.
So it's a feature of all PPPs, but it's really, really important. It's one of the main drivers of the case for PPPs.
Okay. So maybe we can move to Donal. You've got some experience on broadband. You've done some research on maybe the benefits of broadband in different regions. Maybe we could just touch on that first to set the context, and then we could go on to...
Yeah, I mean, that research was done with colleagues in the at the time, the ESRI, people like Edgar Morgan, Sean Lyons, and Darren McCoy. But really, that paper was looking at new firm locations. So, and it was looking at all types of infrastructure. So what are the main drivers of the decision for firms to locate? And obviously, broadband was found to be a significant component of that, but it was really, I think you had to look at all the different types of infrastructure that were in place in that particular region along with that. So it wouldn't really have been looking at the benefits of connecting a farmhouse out in the middle of nowhere in the countryside. It was more looking at new firm location,
yeah,
but still relevant, obviously, to everything. I'm picking up on what Owen said. I mean, the model that's been currently used for the National Broadband Plan, which is it's slightly different to the types of PPPs that Owen was talking about, in that it's a gap funding model,
yeah,
which is essentially almost a more extreme form of PPP, in that normally with a standard public-private partnership, at the end of 25 or 30 years, the asset reverts to public ownership. Whereas with the gap funding model, the asset actually remains in private ownership. So the effect, you know, the government will effectively put some money in, as does the private sector. But it's the private sector that will end up owning the asset at the end of that lifetime.
Right.
And at the time it was put forward, when they were considering the ownership options, they did look at a classic PPP along the lines where the asset reverts, and they looked at the gap funding model. And the decision was to go with the gap funding model based on the assumption that there would be strong competition for the contract, and that incumbent firms, and they were name-checked, such as AIR, yeah, and the CSIRO, the ESP Vodafone joint venture, would attach a significant strategic value to winning that contract, integrating it into its own existing infrastructure, etc.
So they would bid competitively.
Yeah, so there would be strong competition from incumbent industry players, basically, for that contract. And the entire rationale for pursuing that model was hinged on that. And in that mix was also, it was expected that if there was such strong competition, if there was a big strategic value being placed by the bidders on that contract, it would lower the subsidy to government and would deliver this infrastructure at the lowest cost possible to the exchequer.
Yeah.
But those assumptions were, they were very weak to begin with, in that really you'd only two main players, AIR and CSIRO. And at the time that this decision was made, AIR had already announced that it was planning to invest in fibre broadband in, I think, about 300,000 premises within the so-called intervention area in rural Ireland.
Yeah,
which is already kind of signalling that, hang on a sec, the whole plan might change significantly if AIR is to follow through on that, because now if they take the best 300,000, the less lucrative in terms of the commercial return,
yeah,
premises are the only ones left. Who's really going to want to bid for them? But the government ploughed ahead, and all the different kind of stages of the saga that we've gone through in terms of CSIRO exiting the competition, AIR itself exiting the competition, and the huge escalation in cost that we've seen with the preferred bidder Granaghan McCourt, the only one left in the game at the moment. It all comes back to that decision at the very beginning: let's go with this gap funding model and assume competition in what is a very, it's not like a motorway, this is a highly complex,
yeah,
sector where the technology is constantly changing, the intervention area can change, competition is always evolving in certain, yeah, parts of the market, and it just simply was an ill-suited model.
So the companies bidding for this contract, was it a standard contract to serve every household in the country, or was there variation around that? How did that work?
I think it was initially split up into two or three different lots. I can't remember how many they split the country into, a number of different lots, and you could, yeah, bid for one section of the country or the whole.
Yeah.
But effectively, all those that did bid for the whole contract. But if it was to meet the Department of Communications criteria, which was to connect every single household in the intervention area.
Connect every household to fibre broadband? Or
fibre in the vast majority, and, yeah, only in a limited number of cases where it just simply was not feasible would they look at fixed wireless or other types of solutions like,
right,
that.
Okay.
No. Effectively, yeah, the vast majority would be through fibre connections.
Okay, so there's no cost benefit analysis between the distributed areas and the rural areas?
In terms of the different technologies.
Yeah, or was there much economic analysis into the cost benefit of the additional cost of getting one, bringing fibre out to rural Mayo, for example, versus serving it through these? Or was it like a rule of thumb type of
I'm not
approach?
Sure exactly how they went about the cost benefit. They did conduct obviously a cost benefit analysis, and there were big issues with that too, because,
right,
I think at one stage when the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform deeper. The infamous kind of memo from Robert Watt, the Secretary General of that department, to the Secretary General of Communications. I mean, they had huge issues with the cost benefit analysis in terms of, I think it was an overestimation of benefits, was it?
That's right. I mean, the CBA the information that's in the public domain about the CBA is quite limited. The only information that that has been placed in the public domain has been around the very simple CBA, either to go ahead with the project or not to go ahead with it. And it's only when things like Deeper, for instance, voicing concerns about the project that you, as you know, an outsider, get a glimpse of what's really going on in the inside. Because had they not expressed those concerns and put them on the record, we'd be none the wiser about the fact that, as Donal alluded to, the fact that Deeper highlighted how there were changes to the estimated costs and benefits in the run-up to the final the finalisation of the CBA. And they also questioned, they raised a lot of questions about the valuation of the benefits in particular. Now, of course, it's very difficult to put to identify every single benefit and to put a value on it, but the consultants that were hired to do it were pretty well paid to do so. And we're at the stage now where one of the suggestions that has come from the Joint Directors Committee that looked into the conduct of the procurement so far is that the CBA be done again. And that, you know, that just highlights this whole issue around governance of infrastructure policy. It's complex, and it's really important that you get it right to ensure that, you know, public money is spent as efficiently as possible.
In terms of where does it go from here, have you any take on how you see things developing?
Well, it's hard to tell, but I mean, it looks very much like they're just going to sign off and reach financial close. So I know the Oireachtas Committee issued its report after a number of different hearings. I mean, myself and Owen, we met with them and presented our criticisms, but they met with PwC, they met with KPMG, they met with a lot of different parties. They produced their report, which is obviously highly negative and made lots of different recommendations, but in terms of the government reaction, it looked very clear to me anyway that they're simply just going to proceed to financial close on this contract. So that's where it's going to go, and we'll just have to see how it all plays out. But a big issue here, and maybe something Owen didn't get into on the PPP side of thing, will be the transparency and accountability around this. So if this contract is signed and does go ahead, I mean, the key will always be what kind of information is going to be made publicly available on the financial returns to this company, on exactly how much subsidy has obviously been paid to the, all of that type of information. Yeah. Up until only very recently, if you're looking at PPPs or even public infrastructure, it's just not in the public domain. Post-project reviews, which were meant to have been carried out under the PPP guidelines in Ireland, it's only with the Public Accounts Committee taking a big review into PPPs last year and the year before, that's almost forced certain departments to say, well, actually, yeah, we're going to start conducting these post-project reviews to start release more and more information. And the type of oversight that you need just for the general public or for academics like myself or Owen to be able to scrutinise it and say, is this doing what they're saying it would do? Simply has to, we need to see more of that. If we're really to learn the lessons from the past and really see whether or not these things are delivering value for money, including the National Broadband Plan, the key to it all will be transparency and accountability around the decisions that were made.
Well, it seems like a recipe for disaster, giving a private company this key piece of infrastructure. And if you think about broadband becoming the centre, like the means of teleporting all sorts of telecommunications and entertainment and everything to households. And if you've one private company who are running that and deciding who gets the bandwidth and who sells it, it sounds like it's going to be very anti-competitive in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, as much as they can, and this makes economic sense, they'll be using existing infrastructure, be it AIRs or ESPs or whoever, to roll out their network. But in terms of the ownership of it, I mean, I could... Look, if it had turned out that that had been the most competitive procurement process possible, that the subsidy had been, you know, minimised to the largest extent possible, you'd kind of say, okay, well, the government has gotten a key piece of infrastructure here for next to nothing. That's a good thing. But the problem with the model that we're looking at right now is it's actually the state that is putting in the vast majority of the investment that's required. Yeah. It's something... if you exclude VAT and you exclude maybe some of the contingent kind of subsidies that might have to be made under certain circumstances, it's still 2.1 billion of public funds that are being transferred to the private sector.
2.1 billion of what's the total then?
This was a big part of the, you know, when the government were talking about investment, they used to bandy about a 5 billion figure and say it's 5 billion euro in investment. But a lot of that, what they were calling investment, was actually OPEX in the future. So once it's been up, it's up and running, it's right. just the cost of maintaining, operating that network, etc. The upfront, the kind of in the first, you know, I think it's a 7-year rollout, but in those first 7 years, the upfront cost of rolling out that fibre and investing in the technology, the CAPEX side of things, capital expenditure, that is almost entirely being funded by the government, that 2.1 billion of subsidy. The rest of the investment the government is talking about, if you looked at the documents that were released, is more the OPEX, which can be funded from user revenues in the future. So really, it all boiled down to, I think it was about a 220 million equity injection from the preferred bidder and over 2 billion of a capital subsidy paid for by the government as the company hits its milestones. But effectively, that company will end up owning that asset despite having put very little into it and have very little skin in the game in terms of its initial equity contribution.
Yeah, I see this brings us back to the question of, you know, risk sharing.
Yeah.
Because one of the risks, there are all sorts of risks attached to a big infrastructure investment. But one of the advantages of PPP, we're told, is that the private company will take on the financial risk.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting case, really, the case of Ireland's National Broadband Plan, because you could see a lot of the features of, you know, of PPP governance coming into play. And one is the issue that Donal raised around the need for openness, transparency, and so on, so that the public can be assured that things are done well. The government went to extraordinary lengths to ensure that the kind of details we're discussing here didn't come out into the public domain. So the week that the preferred bidder was appointed, we still didn't know exactly what the private company was putting in up front in terms of finance for this project. Mm-hmm. And it was only by accident, I think one of the ministers let it slip in a radio interview, that we learned that it was in the region of 220 million. But as Donal pointed out, if the government is actually going to pay in terms of the subsidy in the region of 2.1 billion or possibly even more, the degree to which the private company has skin in the game or is taking financial risk is clearly not as great as we might have thought to begin with. Now, they are taking other risks. You know, we can rest assured that is actually the case.
Yeah.
But given that there was no competition for the contract at the very end, okay,
yeah.
And that's one of the main drivers of value for money under PPP, and then there are questions certainly about the extent of risk transfer or the degree to which the private sector is taking on risk. This pointed us to the conclusion that we cannot in any way be confident that this will yield what we consider to be value for money or a cost efficient provision of this vital infrastructure. And so, you know, that's the National Broadband Plan, which kind of really brings a lot of these, you know, these kind of issues into focus. But the discussion that we've had today would suggest that we are very anti PPP, as it were. But I don't think that would be the case. Actually, I believe that PPP has an awful lot of virtue and a lot of and a lot of potential, but only if it's governed correctly.
Okay.
And all those elements of governance are the ones that we talked about: competition for contracts, risk transfer, and they can only to a large degree, public decision makers. You know, be it politicians or civil servants or people working in procuring authorities that are held accountable for the decisions that they actually made. And this is one of the big issues with all infrastructure procurement. And it's not just a PPP problem. People get kind of excited about PPP because a lot of the details around commercial contracts are hidden and so on. And that's absolutely the case. But the track record around transparency and openness around other public investments by the traditional means are not easily accessed. So I think that if PPP are a new model and something that we'll use more and more going down the line, well, we should actually take advantage of the the aspects that can drive these efficiencies, but they will only really materialise if there's a degree of openness and accountability that's required.
So is there a good example then of a PPP in an Irish context that worked particularly well?
It's very... To be able to judge it, you need to have access to a lot of the different figures. So the only... A big contrast between ourselves and the UK has actually been the lack of kind of any major review of the performance of PPP that actually has access to all of the required information, the data, the financial figures, etc. So the CNAGs, it did conduct a review into the pilot schools project, so a grouped bundle of schools. But that was back in 2004. Right. There has been no major review by the Comptroller and Auditor General, CNAG, or any other body of PPP. In recent years, the Public Accounts Committee has started scrutinising these things and requesting post-project reviews. A lot more has come into the public domain. Deeper and other bodies have started publishing reports on PPP. But if you look across the water to the UK, the National Audit Office and HM Treasury, they've published its 50 or 67 major reviews into the performance of PPP. And I think if we really wanted to answer that question in Ireland, you would need that type of a very detailed review of a number of different projects, or, you know, the entire programme to date. And that just simply hasn't happened.
It's worth taking into account that in the UK, you know, they've had over 700 PPP projects signed off, whereas in Ireland, you're literally talking in the region of about 30. Okay, if you exclude the water service PPPs, which weren't privately financed. But having said that, in the UK, PPPs have more or less dried up, really, in terms of being used as a procurement option. That tells a story in itself. So just yesterday at the Tory party conference, it was announced that the Tory government were planning on investing a lot of money in new hospitals over the coming years. But very interestingly, and I picked this up on the news item, very specifically, they are not using the PFI option. Because of problems with the PFI.
So PFI is
PPP in the UK, essentially, Finance Initiative. And that, will say, political decision is informed by the accumulation of evidence that is in the public domain, that was put together largely by independent auditors like the National Audit Office in the UK, as well as a very vociferous constituency of academics who've analysed PPP inside out, albeit often on the basis of pretty limited information. But I think the bottom line here is that it appears that PPP has gone out of fashion in the country that it was identified most closely with it. But it doesn't really... For me, it doesn't alter the fact that PPP is a solution, is offered as an alternative to a pretty flawed approach to procuring infrastructure, which is traditional procurement. And even though it appears to have gone out of fashion, I think it can still actually work to a degree if they're properly managed. And we get over this hurdle that you mentioned at the very start about the higher cost of private finance, which is easier said than done.
Yeah, okay. Now, that's a good roundup of how to effectively implement PPP in that context. It's hard to talk about PPP without talking about roads and infrastructure, and that's probably the most salient example. So the PPP structure probably would have meant that a lot of projects got off the ground quicker or perhaps had benefits. Maybe you can talk us through the potential benefits, but how do these weigh up against...
Okay. Well, in the motorway sector in particular, Owen and I, we've actually... done our best to analyse the performance of the early... Really, we have two phases of motorway infrastructure PPPs. The first phase is tolled motorways. Mm. So the likes of the Limerick Tunnel will be tolled, you know, the M7 there at Port Lee. You know, there's about seven, or I think it was eight different projects that had tolls attached to them. Since 2010, effectively, all motorway projects are on availability-based contracts. So there's no tolls. It's just the government, almost like a mortgage, paying the private sector for the availability of that motorway for the next 25, 30, however many years it is. I mean, the early tolled motorways, I mean, why were they built? Well, at the time, we'd one of the, I think, the lowest amount of motorway infrastructure in terms of the density of our road network. And there was a real pressing need with the economy booming as it did to invest in this infrastructure. So PPP was seen as a way of doing that. But it's very quickly gone away from the use of tolls, and a lot of that is down to the difficulties around traffic forecasting. So those contracts, when the firms are competing for them, they're obviously competing based on their forecasts of how many people will be using them. And if they're aggressively trying to win those contracts, they obviously have an incentive to maybe overestimate the amount of traffic that they think will use that road, right, and to put in a lower cost bid. And that happened on a number of projects. But the crisis obviously kicking in meant that a lot of these projects that were suddenly becoming operational in 08, 09, 2010 in particular, but had been signed in 2007, were based on hugely optimistic forecasts around traffic. And there's a number of them in serious financial difficulties. I mean, I think the Waterford Bypass one has something like over 140, 150, I can't remember the figure, but it's a massive amount of accumulated losses, and it's currently in discussions, negotiations with its senior lenders around a restructuring deal. And I think the government is now far more wary based on the experience with the difficulty around forecasting they moved immediately away to the availability base, and even companies themselves bidding for these contracts didn't want to be taking on the risk of that traffic not materialising.
It seems like, though, that's the risk. They entered into that contract, they took on the risk, and they lost the bet, basically.
Yeah, but there was actually an interesting paper by Richard Burke in WIT, and I think it was Stemi Demirag in the UK, and they actually interviewed for three of those tolled road projects some of the bidders, the special purpose vehicle companies that operate these companies. And some of the quotes that came out of those interviews, I mean, some of the bidders are effectively just expecting, look, if we get this wrong, we can renegotiate. You know, the extent to which actual risk is being transferred there. You know, if we aggressively go after this and it doesn't turn out that way, sure, we can just renegotiate. It's fine. We'll be in a contract and it's locked in at that stage. You know, see, there's so that dynamic that's going on when you're dealing with the difficulties around traffic forecasts and the actual risk being taken on by the winning bidder if it gets its traffic forecast wrong. Now, that hasn't happened yet in Ireland. There hasn't been a renegotiation yet. But it's not really a surprise that they've completely gone away from the tolled kind of user charge type motorway contracts and moved to availability to try and eliminate all of the messing around in terms of traffic forecasting and risk.
And that has been the case internationally. There is an international trend away from, say, the transfer of demand risk and moving towards these more availability based payments. And you know what? That actually makes sense, because there's no point, you know, a procurement process cannot be optimal, it cannot be efficient if it's based on bids that are wildly optimistic about demand, about traffic flows and so on. And that appears to have happened in not just in the Irish case, it has been the international experience. There are some horror stories from Spain, where it is nearly all the motorway contracts have been renegotiated for that very reason. Just to provide a single example. In a sense, it's reassuring that the evidence, as far as we're aware, there hasn't been any renegotiations on the motorway contracts, and the Transport Infrastructure Ireland seems to be sticking to the terms of the contract so far. And if it does happen that one of these project companies gets into financial difficulty, it'd be interesting to see who pays for it. The lenders be on the hook, or will there be a bailout? But it's one well worth looking out for over the coming years to see how this actually plays out. But it does come back, you know, to the points we made at the very beginning. Getting these risk allocation mechanisms right in the terms of a contract is easier said than done. And, you know, governments, they face trade-offs. You know, there's an urgency around the need to get these assets built. So they're very keen to enter into the contracts. And they might get them built, but you might be storing up trouble for future generations down the line, because these are long-term contracts. And that's what makes this area an interesting one to study, notwithstanding the fact that it can be frustrating, because a lot of this information is hard to get your hands on.
Okay, so maybe just for the last few minutes then, to wrap up, you've done some work on Aircom, and this is something that a lot of people will be familiar with. of course, I always think that these are things that are happened yesterday, but it's actually quite a while ago. But
it's 20 years ago now since the flotation of Aircom.
20 years last July.
So I remember I was in school at the time when Aircom was privatised, and everybody was talking about, are you buying Aircom shares? How many are you buying? And some people were pouring money and everything to buy shares, which is craziness. But I suppose the first place to start then is, why was Aircom privatised in the first place? What was the rationale?
Look, there's a lot of different factors. You know, if you look at what was happening in the wider European telecom sector, obviously the entire market was in the process of being liberalised in the 1990s, and full liberalisation and the opening up of competition of the European telecom sector, I think, was due to occur in 1996, and we had a small derogation till I think the 1st of January 1998 in Ireland. So you had that going on in the background in terms of a previously monopolistic industry being liberalised, and the kind of idea of, I suppose, the sleepy former incumbent suddenly being woken up to the forces of competition would require maybe some private, even if in the form of a strategic alliance, or, you know, but basically need to be freed from its shackles in order to compete in this new world. So there's an element of what was happening on the liberalisation side of things. In Europe, again, also, there was a big wave of privatisation beginning to happen, and across a number of utility sectors, but chiefly, especially because of the dot-com bubble that we saw in the late 1990s, a massive amount of the privatisation revenues that were generated in Europe came from the flotation of stakes in the national incumbent telecoms operator. So that was a European dynamic that was going on. And we were no different in Ireland in terms of our evolution. And the government's stance at the time was that, look, if Telecom Éireann is really going to survive in this newly liberalised environment, if it's going to be completely freed up to pursue its own commercial strategic objectives, the only way it'll be free to do so is if it's a private entity. And at the same time then, because of a bit of the dot-com bubble vibe going on, just like you were alluding to there, Mary O'Rourke, the Minister for Public Enterprise at the time, saw there was a big opportunity there to, almost like Thatcher in the 80s, a kind of a popular capitalism approach. Let's create a democracy of small shareholders and open up this share issuing to all citizens, and really make it a company of the people in that sense. And it was a huge advertising campaign, if you think back, in terms of trying to entice people to invest and to purchase shares in this company. I think about 1.2 million people registered interest, and about 580,000 actually ended up purchasing shares. So that's a massive portion of the population. So you had a lot of that going on too. And obviously, I think the top management of the company was in favour. So all of those factors really kind of met in a perfect confluence of things that pushed towards the privatisation of the company. But what set us apart from the rest of Europe, so we were unique in this regard, was we were the only country that at the point of flotation, the government sold its entire stake in the company. If you look at what happened in every other European country, the UK is different because they privatised BT back in the 1980s in different stages. But for most other Western European countries, governments would have floated an initial stake, and then gradually over time they would have, you know, sold another tranche over time as the market developed and competition developed, and they could more accurately price as well the tranche of shares that they wanted to sell. Or if they sold their entire shareholding, they kept what was called a golden share. A golden share is basically a veto over any undesirable change in ownership. Yeah. But when it came to Ireland, and the government came to the flotation of the company in July 1999, it had always been the case that said all along, look, they were going to sell about 30%, because the CompSource consortium, KPN and Telia, which had purchased 20% of the company in 1996, they were able to exercise an option to get another 15%. Employees got an employee share ownership plan of 14.9%. So the government had 50.1%, a majority stake to play around with. Yeah. And it had never said it was going to sell its entire shareholding. And then suddenly, in the final month, it suddenly announced it was selling it all. Now, maybe that was because they could see there was huge valuation being put on companies at almost the peak of the dot-com bubble. But by them selling their all of their shares, not retaining any kind of golden share or a blocking minority stake or just some kind of veto over undesirable changes in ownership, that's effectively been the, I suppose, the main issue that's caused all the problems we've seen today. Obviously, they can't see into the future, but the fact that we haven't been able to prevent the highly leveraged buyouts by private equity groups that we saw in 2001 and again in 2006 that led to the eventual, the company going into examinership and going bust, all of that was purely because at that time we made that decision to sell everything in one go without separating out the network element from the retail okay. side of business.
So it was sold off, and then the private equity group had a leveraged buyout. That happened on two occasions, I think.
Yeah, so effectively, everything was fine for the first... Well, not everything was fine. But everyone goes on about the share price, but if you actually look back for a couple of weeks after the IPO, the share price went up.
Yeah.
And if you calculate underpricing, the underpricing of the share based on its IPO price and its price at the close of trading on the very first day, I think it was something like 18%. There was a significant underpricing of Aircom's flotation IPO price. It's only obviously then, if you fast forward a couple of months, the dot-com bubble, everything that... It wasn't necessarily a problem that Aircom... Everyone looked at Aircom and said, it's a highly inefficient company and all these. It was just the wider
market
dynamic.
Yeah.
The share price started to plummet. And it was around about 2000 where I think the company would have been under pressure. Obviously, small shareholders that had held on to these shares were very unhappy. Mm-hmm. And they were approached by Vodafone, who made an offer for the mobile business, Aircel, at the time.
Yeah.
And they decided, and again, it was a bizarre decision because it was an all-share offer by Vodafone, and there was a break clause where if Vodafone's shares had fallen below a certain price by the time that sale was meant to happen, that they could actually pull from the sale of Aircel to Vodafone. And the Vodafone's price was well below that break price at the time that the sale went through, but they still went ahead because, again, maybe the management were under pressure in terms of needing to get some kind of return back to small shareholders. But that was led to the kind of breakup of the firm. So Aircel was demerged, sold to Vodafone, and it was only then that the remaining fixed line business, so the actual copper network, etc., the remaining business outside of mobile suddenly became open to offers. And then we saw the kind of the rival bids between Dennis O'Brien's E-Island Consortia and Tony O'Reilly's Valentia Consortia. And in 2001, it was... Tony O'Reilly's Valentia Consortium that conducted a highly leveraged buyout of the company, which loaded on, I think it was $2.2 billion in debt as part of that buyout.
So just to explain that to a lot of people who mightn't understand.
Okay, well, basically, I can't remember the exact price that was put on the business, but let's say it's about $3 billion. So when they paid $3 billion for Aircom, which was now just the remaining fixed line business, about $600 to $800 million of that was actual equity invested by the Valentia Consortium, and the rest was debt, but using obviously the existing assets of the company as collateral. So in terms of Aircom's balance sheet, it went from, I think, having negative net debt. It had more cash than it had debt at the time to suddenly having over $2 billion in debt. That's not debt that's been raised to invest in, replacing bits of infrastructure or new exchanges, nothing like that. It's just purely as a result of that LBO.
Yeah.
And then they went around pursuing basically strategies of cash extraction. I think within 18 months, they'd paid themselves a special dividend of over 500 million euro.
Yeah.
So they'd almost all their money back straight away.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of cash extraction. And then usually the goal of these types of private equity LBOs, the leverage buyouts, is to exit in 3 to 5 years. And that's exactly what they did. They refloated Aircom in 2004, made obviously a nice return on their investment. But the killer blow was in 2006, a second LBO by Babcock and Brown occurred. And that added on another $2.2 billion. And now Aircom's debt was the highest of any If you looked at its net debt to earnings, EBITDA, earnings before interest, depreciation, tax and amortization, it was off the charts, the highest in Europe, way beyond what's sustainable for any company. And I suppose then the crisis hits, all of those things, and by 2010, it effectively went into examinership. STT, which was a Singapore-based company, they did buy it for something like 140 million, I think it was 2009, because of its debt burden. But it was just basically gone effectively by 2011, I think, was when it went into examinership.
But the fallout from that story, I mean, we're coming around in the circle again here, is that as a result of that buildup of debt and the need to pay that debt off, the company didn't invest adequate resources in its fixed line infrastructure. So in all the league tables of availability of broadband infrastructure, Ireland was at the bottom of the pile throughout the 2000s, and it's still fairly low in terms of the penetration of, we'll say, fibre optic cable and so on, or high speed broadband. And you know, in a sense, this brought the government to the point where it had to go and intervene again in the market because of market failure, and hence the National Broadband Plan. You know, so all this can be traced back to the fallout from the Aircom privatisation. And as Donal said, it's funny, it's not funny, but it's odd that it came down to one really strange, hard to fathom, but really poor decision, when that was to sell the company in its entirety. Because the government lost control over what, of course, was a strategic asset. And even though the circumstances are different now around the National Broadband Plan, under the, you know, this gap funding model that they're going to use, the infrastructure, albeit just cable, you know, not necessarily the masts and poles, etc. But it will be owned by the private sector at the end of the contractual period, and it's in a sense there's a degree of history repeating itself, and it's the kind of public policy decision that really has you scratching your head about whether this is really in the interests of the country, particularly in the long term. Clearly the decision to privatise back in 1999 was driven by this frenzy, you know, from a political perspective, where people could make money and this would make us really popular. But you might, or you may or may not remember, when in the run up to the election, and I think it was it the 2002 or 2007 election, Fine Gael actually suggested that they compensate the shareholders in Aircom for the losses they made. I mean, crazy stuff, okay? But it just shows
very
you what kind of
thing to
what
do.
Kind of a populist. But it shows you kind of a political football infrastructure can be, and especially you throw into the mix the whole idea of private ownership, privatization, the involvement of private equity groups, it can get very messy, you know.
Yeah, no, I always think, so my own field being electricity, and when that was privatised and everything was unbundled, generation, and then you have the infrastructure, and the infrastructure is a natural monopoly, and that I imagine that should be the same for telecoms.
I was about to make that point. I mean, no one is saying that the government should have retained ownership over all aspects of the telecommunication, you know, as in the services, mobile. Of course there's going to be some competitive aspects, and mobile has obviously developed a huge amount, and there's been lots of other competition around different technologies in the telecom sector. But for the National Broadband Plan, you know, and the kind of interventions before that, like the Metropolitan Area Networks Plan, they've all been trying to target the market failure that emerged in the fixed line infrastructure section. So to an extent, the government learned their lessons when Bord Gáis was sold, because they sold the energy business, the retail side of the business, and they retained the network, the gas transmission network in public ownership under GasLink. I think in the post-crisis period, they had initially talked about selling a stake in the ESB, but quickly rolled back on that. And at the time, there was a lot of talk too about the separation of the transmission distribution grid from the retail side. It's exactly the same type of thing with Aircom. If we had sold the entire company but retained maybe ownership of an unbundled network element of that, then we wouldn't be in the same situation that we're in right now, because it's hard to say exactly what the counterfactual is and exactly how would it would have turned out. But for sure, it would not have been the case that private equity groups would have gotten their hands on it, sweated those assets, extracted as much as they could from them. They had loads of sale and lease back type things going on, not invested as much as they otherwise would. We were, I think, with a 2-year lag between the first rollout of broadband in Ireland and every other European country, and we've been just constantly playing catch up. Those types of things, no matter how inefficient you might want to assume, if you're of that ideology, public enterprise might be, would definitely not have been the case if we'd at least had some control and say over the future direction of that fixed line infrastructure.
Yeah. No, it seems that the incentives are all wrong, because if you have a private company, they don't have an incentive to develop it at all.
Yeah, and you see this a lot in the UK in particular. There's been a lot of studies done on different sectors there, especially in water and areas that were privatised a long time ago. And they've, if you look at the balance sheets of these companies, there's been a lot of financial engineering going on, not enough investment. And bizarrely for the UK, there's been some fairly conservative type of commentators saying that they may have to consider a return to mutualisation or a public ownership type option for some of these companies, because not enough has been invested in. And it's the market failures now all around the, how do we get private companies to invest, particularly in, say, rural areas, at the pace that we want to require them to. It's very hard to incentivise that as a regulator.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Owen and Donal, I'm conscious of time. Thanks very much for that very interesting discussion.
Pleasure, yeah.
And I really enjoyed it.
If you like the podcast, remember to follow us on @IrishEconPod on Twitter, Facebook or Instagram. If you get a chance, a 5-star Apple review would really help. So thanks everybody. Thanks again and all the best.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.